So now it is my pleasure to welcome you to the session on genetic counseling for families. This afternoon's session will be presented by Ms. Joey Davis. Ms. Davis is a retired nurse practitioner at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, National Institutes of Health, within the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Please join me in welcoming Joey Davis.
Hi, everybody. So we want this to be just as informal as possible because it helps me control my nerves. So if I'm talking about something that I haven't made clear or that you don't understand, I want you to please just hold up your hand or shout out to me. Can you hear me all right? Okay. So here's some of the things that I'd like to talk about today with you. And just to start us out on the same page, that we're all on the same, have the same understanding about some basic genetic concepts, I'm going to take a few slides and start there. And then we're going to talk about why it's important in identifying the genetic basis of a disorder, particularly an immune disorder, since that's what brings us here. We'll talk about some of the types of genetic tests available, and then we'll talk about some of the challenges that professionals and patients have before and after the testing is done. So I want to start off with this screen, and if some of you have ever heard some of my talks before, this is pretty standard. I do this just to get us, like I said, at the same point of understanding. This is the blueprint, and obviously it contains all the information that someone would need to build a structure. The electrical system and the lighting and everything would be contained in a blueprint. So, Sam, you've heard this talk two or three times. You can just stand up and give it for me right now. So, included in these chromosomes is the master plan or the blueprint for how we all turn out. Everything we inherit, everything about us is embedded in this blueprint. And these structures are called chromosomes, as you know. And the first rule of nature is that we must have 23 pair or 46 individual chromosomes. They come in pairs because I get 23 chromosomes from my mom, I get 23 chromosomes from my dad, matching chromosomes, and that's where we get the pair. So the sperm cells contain 23 chromosomes, the egg cells contain 23 chromosomes. And then when the egg is fertilized by the sperm, that's where the fetus gets the 46. So this is what a male chromosome picture looks like, and the scientific term is a karyotype. So the X and the Y is what designates the male. The two X's are the female, but everything between chromosome 1 and chromosome 22 is the same between males and females. So the first 15 or 20 years that I was in genetics, this was the basic test we could do. This was about the only test we could do. If a family came in and the child had a particular disease or a particular birth defect, we would do one of these studies to see if there were 46 chromosomes. This is a test that we could do with the help of a microscope. Your natural eye, looking through a microscope, can see these structures. So we would count them, and if a patient had exactly the right number with nothing missing and nothing extra, we were not able to help identify or tell them, would this happen again? Was it something that just happened for the first time? Was it something that would be inherited? So we were very, very limited, and we, because of the Human Genome Project, we're just light years ahead of that now. But starting with the first rule that we have to have 23 pair of chromosome, no more, no less, let's see what happens when that rule is broken. So here we have a young person with three chromosome 21s, and we know this is Down syndrome, or trisomy 21. This is the most common chromosome mistake that occurs. One out of 800 people have this extra chromosome number 21. And having this extra chromosome 21 gives those children and adults the same features. They look more like each other than they do their biological relatives. They have small hands, small feet. They're often short. And we know now that that extra 21, that extra dose of chromosome 21 in adults with Down syndrome have a higher risk for Alzheimer's syndrome. So there's something about 21 that this has taught us about Alzheimer's. This is not enough genetic material. So this is an example of, I told you just a few minutes ago, women have two X chromosomes, and this young lady only has one, and this condition is called Turner syndrome. And these ladies are usually short, under 5 feet. There's some problems with the development of their female organs, so childbirth can be an issue. And we've learned also that if a fetus or a developing embryo has only one X chromosome, that's the most common cause of a first trimester miscarriage. So a developing baby or an embryo needs either that Y chromosome or the second X chromosome for the best reproductive fitness. So that's an example of not enough genetic material. And what I'm going to show you now is a little of both. We got a nice chromosome 5, one copy, completely there. Most of the second chromosome number 5 is there, but the very tip is missing. And there's lots and lots of genetic information in that very tip. And so there are a lot of genes in there that are completely gone. And this condition, when this happens, this condition is called cri de chat, or cry of the cat. And these youngsters have very weak cries. They have very small heads. They're very difficult to comfort. And they're pretty severely developmentally delayed. So what I've just shown you are chromosome abnormalities that are visible to the naked eye. Now we're going to talk about genes, which are not visible to the naked eye, and we need way more advanced methodology to see those. But let's go to the next slide. So what I would like to ask you to do is envision this chromosome, and I've just put chromosome 1 up here. But I want you to think about all the chromosomes as being a necklace. And you can see the necklace, just like you can see the chromosome with your naked eye, but you can't see the beads on the string. And those are the genes. And what we know now is that each chromosome carries thousands of genes. And if we were to count up all those genes or all the beads that are located on all of the chromosomes, this is how many we have, 21,500. I used to think it was 80, well, we all used to think it was between 80 and 100,000 genes, but this is really the blueprint for all of us, is 21,000 genes, half of which we get from each parent. So just like there's rules about the chromosomes, there have to be 23 pair or 46. There also have to be rules followed about a gene, and when those genes are broken, then we have undesirable results. So let's just open up a gene and look at it. And this is what it looks like scientifically. There's a string of words here. The first thing I want you to notice is that the DNA alphabet is A, C, G, and T. The second rule is, what do you notice about these words other than capital letters? They're all three letters, right? They're all three-letter words. So that's the second rule. So each word in a gene, we've called the gene a bead so far. I'm going to call it a sentence of instruction because it's a DNA sentence of instruction for making something, building the protein for an eye or a bone or a heart. I'm also going to call it a recipe because we're going to use a lot of cooking analogies here. So Here are, if you combine A, C, G, and T into every three-letter word combination, you're going to come up with 64 words. And those words are a code for something else, which I'm going to show you on the next slide. But every gene has ATG, which is, means start. It tells the DNA machinery we're about to make something. In cooking language, it might mean preheat the oven. And then every gene has a stop message right here at the end. And it's one of these three words, spelled TGA or TAA or TAG, but those are the stop. We're take out and cool. We're finished. Now, let's look and see what those three-letter words do. Here are the 20 amino acids or ingredients or building blocks that are used to build a human from skin out. And every time the DNA machinery reads one of these four three-letter words, it will drop in this amino acid or this ingredient, alanine. Same goes all the way down the line. If one of these seven words is read by the DNA machinery, it will drop in arginine. And then you see the start message there. That drops in methionine. And these are the three stop messages that tell the DNA machinery, quit adding things. We're done. We're completely finished making something. Let's see how this looks. So there's our gene of instruction. So this, the start message, ATG, drops in that amino acid, then tyrosine, then lysine, and alanine, and leucine, and right on down the line. And the order in which these genes drop that amino acid in make a huge difference. It's very, very important. Like if you were making a cake, you wouldn't add the flour and then the yeast. You would do all the other things first before you added the yeast, just like a recipe. So there has to be a method for which the DNA machinery adds these things to make the protein or the body part that it's the code for or the blueprint for. Now, we haven't talked about the capital letters or the little letters. The capital letters fit inside these boxcars called exons. And those are, as you saw in the previous slide, these words and capital letters tell the DNA machinery, give the DNA machinery instructions about which amino acid to put in next. Then it gets to a little GTG at the end of the boxcar. That's the DNA machinery's code for take a break. We're not going to add anything, just sit down and rest. It reads through the intron, the connector, till it gets to AAG. AAG is a break time's over. Now we must go add the next thing, GCA. And it keeps on going. And so you'll notice that at the end of every boxcar, there's a little GTG. And at the beginning of every boxcar is a little AAG, and that just signifies that, you know, this is over. So, I give you this kind of basic instruction so you'll understand what happens next when things go wrong within the gene. And then this is me trying to be cute using three-letter words, asking you if I've made this clear. Are you understanding this? Okay. Now, here's some basic genetic trivia. We said just a few minutes ago we got 21,500 genes, but not all of them have the same amount of letters in them. So here is a gene that we called autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome, and the gene is called FAS that causes that disease. So that's a small gene, 1,836 letters in it, A, C, T's, and G's. Here's a gene that causes the hyper-IgE syndrome, and the gene's called STAT3. It's a bigger gene, 75,000 letters in it. Then there's the breast cancer gene, which is even bigger, and it has 110,000 letters. But look at this one. Here's a gene that causes muscular dystrophy. The name of the gene is called dystrophin, and it's 2,400,000 ACTs and Gs that fit into 79 of those boxcars. So that might make us ask the question, well, if there are 21,500 genes, how many DNA letters or alphabet does it take to spell out 21,000 genes? And there's the answer, 3 billion. So let me put that in context for you. If we had many truckloads of ACTs and Gs, let's say 3 billion ACTs and Gs, and I gave us the assignment in this room to just grab them and make three-letter words and start sticking them in an encyclopedia, how many encyclopedias would that take? So we'd start at the ground, and we'd do the first set. We'd keep going and keep going and keep going till we had a stack that would span the top of the Washington Monument. That's how much DNA is just in one cell. So let's think about how tightly packed this cell is. It comes with how many chromosomes? 46 or 23 pair. And on those chromosomes are 21,000 genes composed of 3 billion ACTs and Gs. So that's the basis for, that's just the bottom basic concepts for DNA. I'm going to show you now what happens inside the DNA that can cause disease, a spelling mistake. No, I just did that, or did I not? I guess I didn't. Basically, if those rules are broken, if there's not a three-letter word, then that causes a problem. If it's only two letters, then that causes a problem. If that stop message is in the wrong place in the gene, that causes a problem. So, what we know about immune genes is getting more and more and more. And what I'm going to talk about here is going to build on the opening session we had when Dr. Norangelo spoke. And he showed a nice graph of the genes that we're getting to know that are related to the immune system over the last 10 or 15 years. And we're up to about between 200 and 300 genes. So scattered throughout over the whole chromosome, there are many, many genes that are absolutely specific for immune disorders. And we have a chip at NIH that studies that I think cover about 247 immune genes. So the next couple of slides are going to address the fact, well, why is it important to know what gene causes the disorder? And I want to show you why. These are very obvious, but they obviously help with diagnosis. If you can find that gene, then you can diagnose the disorder. And it can help diagnose at all levels, at all ages. So from a prenatal perspective, any gene that has been identified in a family can be tested for it in a prenatal condition. So amnios can be done, or CVS sampling can be done, and you can identify anything in a prenatal condition that might help with testing right away or treatment right away as soon as the baby's born. And those things can include X-linked severe combined immune deficiency or CGD or Wiskott-Aldrich. Any condition that has the genetic basis defined can be tested for prenatally. There's also newborn testing. The Guthrie, the toe stick for the Guthrie, we've talked about the X-Skid being something that's been added to this testing panel in many, many states. But a baby, if the gene for hyper-IgE, which is STAT3, is identified, a baby could be checked as soon as it's born for that condition. And so the team can be alerted ahead of time. This child has hyper-IgE syndrome, and these are the things. When it gets its rash, we don't change formulas, and we don't fuss at the mother for keeping the baby's skin clean enough. This goes with this disorder, and we need antibiotics, and we need other things to help. CF, PKU, thyroid disease, sickle cell, all of these can be tested in a newborn state. This is not an immune condition, but even in childhood, if there are young males that are having severe learning issues, they can be tested for a condition called Fragile X, and it's the most common inherited disorder for mental retardation or learning disabilities.
How far are they away from the disease, you know, to be able to test for, like, how do you see that?
For what? So hang on. Yeah, and if I don't address it, get me again. But there are many things that I'm seeing happen now that, like last month, one of the physicians at CHOP referred us 20 patients with CVID and asked us to just test them for some of the genes. And we found in a couple of patients other genes from other their new immune genes. So they come out of the CVID group now and go into this CTLA-4 deficiency or whatever the gene is that we described. So like Dr. Notarangelo said when we opened up, many of the CVID genes are going to get identified into some specific category. But then there's still going to be genes that are going to be found that are strictly CVID. And that's coming. It's coming very quickly. So moving on to the adult benefit of learning a disease gene, and if one has early onset Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, there's things that can be done to increase the quality of life for those individuals in terms of planning and financial resources. So that's diagnostic. So once we've got things diagnosed, then are there things we can do to prevent the disease? And in some cases, yes. So there's pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is possible. And this is where, with the help of laboratory techniques, a sperm can be introduced into an egg and fertilized and then tested at 8 cells big to see if that disease gene is in that embryo. And if it is not, then that embryo can be reimplanted in the mother. So this is happening with breast cancer. This is happening with many, many, many disorders that have been present in families through many generations, and they cannot bear the thought of having a child or a baby go through some of the things that they've done. So they have decided to sort for the embryos that do not carry the diagnosis. So that's possible. There's a condition called factor V Leiden, which is a clotting disorder. If a woman knows she has the gene for factor V Leiden, then it would be very important for her not to be on birth control pills, because birth control pills by themselves is a risk for clotting. So that's something that can be prevented. Condition called hemochromatosis is something where iron cannot be filtered through the body and it accumulates and causes severe problems. And if a person knows they have this disorder, then they get their blood drawn every 6 weeks and get some of that iron pulled off while the body makes new cells. Phenylketonuria is a condition that's also genetic. If we know a child has that, then they can be placed on a phenyl-free diet and have a better quality of life and a relatively normal life. And then obviously other conditions, the breast and ovarian, colorectal cancer, I would say any of the cancers could then have, if a woman decided to have a prophylactic surgery, have her breast removed or her ovaries removed because of a horrific family history and they had the gene for breast cancer, those would be options that would be available. Or if they didn't want to have the surgery, but they would be more diligent about having mammograms every 6 months or colonoscopy. So there's a lot of things that can be done preventively, surveillance-wise, if one knows they have these genes, or even if the family history is there. Now, we've talked about diagnosis. We've talked about preventive strategies. What about medicine? There's a condition. There's just this cool thing called pharmacogenetics, where it's the study of these genetic variations and these alterations that can influence an individual's response to a drug. So if some of those letters, ACTs or Gs, differ at a certain spot in you, they may not cause disease, but maybe that different letter in that spot means that if you take amoxicillin or ampicillin, you're going to have a really bad reaction. You're going to have a toxic reaction. Or maybe if there's a different variation at a different spot in your DNA, that may mean that if you take that drug, it does nothing at all for you. It doesn't do anything for you. So if we wholesale give people medicine just based on they've got an antibiotic, they've got an infection, and we're going to give ampicillin or amoxicillin, we may not be giving the right drug. We may be causing harm. We may be causing the expenses to go up. So the whole thing about personalized medicine is give the right drug, the right dose, the first time, and then we've really taken care of that person. So many of the chemos have been one size fits all for different cancers. And we know now that the chemos are being designed based on the tumor that the specific tumor the person has. Here's the features of this tumor, and here's the chemo that works on that tumor, so that we just don't give the standard chemo to everybody. It's got to be basic. So pharmacogenetics is a super important thing based on the genetics of a person in terms of the drug that's given for them. We've heard a lot of talk this session about gene therapy. Some of you have even probably undergone it with your family members, and this is a condition where I'm most familiar with it, in X-linked disorders, where a boy is going to undergo gene therapy and they're hooked up to a machine much like a dialysis machine, and their blood is circulated through the machine, and just the stem cells are captured, just the size of BBs, but all the other cells are given back, and just the stem cells are captured. They're taken back to the lab. They're exposed to a vector that has the correct gene hooked on it. That vector is then exposed to those cells and hopefully inserts the correct gene and all of the stem cells, and then those cells are given back to the patient. And so this was the first young man at NIH who underwent this for X-linked severe combined immune deficiency. He's doing a little customer oversight here where he's actually, just before his own gene therapy, was looking at the microscope to see what we were seeing. And then this is Dr. Malik giving him his own cells back that have been corrected. It's pretty simple, just sitting in the hospital bed and getting those cells infused. So after gene therapy, what can the gene help us do? The gene can help us identify the biological pathway. If we understand that pathway, what does this gene trigger? What pathway, what happens then? Which chemicals are turned on? Which pathways are blocked? Once we understand that, then maybe we can understand the medicine that can happen. And so we know that there's a drug named Tacrine that has a particular effect on patients that are thought to have Alzheimer's, or Herceptin is another chemo agent for breast cancer. And Gleevec was completely developed and is completely successful in leukemia in terms of reversing or stopping leukemia. So these are all the reasons why it's a huge benefit to know the gene that's causing the immune disorder or any other disorder. Now, let's talk about the testing options for finding out those genes. And the first one's just called a single gene test. And so based on the clinical findings of a young person, I've talked about X-GID a lot. If that young boy is just 3 or 4 months old, it's having continual infections, it's not thriving, it's got eczema and diarrhea that overlaps with many immune disorders, but it's a male, and maybe the physician would then do the test only for X-linked SCID. Or if it's a condition that overlaps many conditions, like someone with a high IgE level and eczema and skin rashes and boils and warts, That could be associated with hyper-IgE, could be associated with a DOC8. So there might be a gene panel that tests for many disorders that have those symptoms in common. So there, that's an option. There's a gene chip, possibly, in many places where they test for hundreds of immune disorders. But this one has a few little pitfalls because some of those chips cannot put all those thousands of letters in their correct order on the chip. So what they've done is engineer the chip, say gene A has 15 mutations, and it's the 15, when I say mutations, I mean spelling mistakes. So it may have the 15 most common mutations seen on that gene, and a patient could have one of the uncommon mutations, and that test could be read as negative. This is normal in your patient. But it's still a good screening. It's going to pick up if somebody has a common mutation or a common genetic disorder. It will pick them up by checking, you know, several hundred genes at one time. And then there's this thing called whole genome or whole exome sequencing. Has anybody been through whole exome sequencing? Okay, so you'll have some particularly interesting comments. And I've got 10 minutes, is that right? Okay. Well, no, we're almost there. So, again, based on the building on the original meeting that we had where Dr. Notarangelo spoke, I showed you a few minutes ago what exons were. They were this huge, big blocks of DNA that come in the boxes, and that's where all the coding, all the message giving is contained in these boxes. So when we say whole exome sequencing, an exome is a collection of all those exons. And there are 180,000 of those, not letters now, 180,000 boxes that contain coding information. And those coding regions constitute about 85% of the disease-causing spelling mistakes or mutations. So it looks like that would be much more sensible to test those big blocks of coding regions. So it is efficient. Sequencing 30 million, which is fit into 180,000 boxes. So looking through 30 million base pairs is certainly more efficient than looking at 3 billion. So the goal here is to identify the variation responsible for the disease without the high cost of sequencing all 3 billion pairs. So let's see what happens. Well, look, what are some of the outcomes when one has whole exome sequencing? Well, there's this thing called incidental or secondary findings. And what those are is it's a finding unrelated to what we were hunting for. So we've started this test looking for genes that are related to the immune system. We may or may not find that gene, but we found these other things that may not be related at all to the immune system. Maybe there's cancer genes there or Alzheimer's genes there or diabetes genes. There may be other things there that we trip over when we're looking for the immune thing. So these are the outcomes that are possible from whole exome sequencing. You're going to find the disease-causing gene. Maybe it's not the disease that you're looking for. It may be the immune-related gene, but it also may be disease-causing genes in some other area not related to the immune system. So it's either disease-causing or likely to cause disease. There are going to be variations that are found that don't cause disease, so that's pretty easy. You don't have to worry about that. But then there are these variations of unknown significance. We're pretty new at this, and so there are lots of variations or spelling mistakes that we're going to trip over or find or discover that we don't know if they're disease-causing or not. We don't know yet. We have to look at the databases, we have to look at what's been written, what's been published, what's been established in all the genetic databases to see. So the decision comes, are these clinically relative findings versus findings of little medical significance? So I'm interested in your consent form when you underwent whole exome sequencing. What were your options when you did that testing? Was it through a research project? So tell us about that. So what did your consent say about, did it kind of give you this layout? We're going to go looking for the genes that are associated with your immune system, but we might find these other things?
It is multi-node intolerance.
All right. All right, so instead of testing the boxcars, they went through all 3 billion letters of everybody that enjoyed, that enrolled in your family, right?
And they found one that had never been reported before.
Okay, but I'm still interested in the preliminary education you got about this process. Did you have a consent that said we may find other things? What do you want us to do with it?
I remember the consent. One of my questions is, she has an obligation to tell us about other significant things you found.
And what was his answer? Ah, okay. All right, so this is important because this is the basis of the next couple of slides. So here's what can possibly happen after one of these big, big genetic searches, whole exome or whole genome. Here are the possible things that can happen. Yes, sir?
What does it cost to do a whole
genome? So the whole genome, I'm not sure. Whole exome is about $5,000. So where you're looking at 3 million versus 3 billion, it's about 5,000 now.
And
it's very expensive, but the cost is coming way down, way, way, way down. So let's say we've gone through one of these whole exome sequencing things, and here's what might be there. So of all those spelling in that 3 billion things, the computer has gone through and read 3 million of them and found 44,000 different little variations. That's the first thing it picked up. So I don't know what bad data is. I'm just going on what the scientists tell me. But they exclude the bad data. Maybe those are computer glitches or things that weren't read correctly. So they exclude the bad data, and they exclude those variations that are not associated with any diseases. So they take those variations out. So after that's done, maybe we're left with 14,000 possible disease-causing variants, and maybe there's some false positives in there, so those get excluded. And that gets us down to 430. Now that's still a lot. So there's 430 different little variants. So maybe in that bunch there's 8 that likely cause disease and need more confirmation, and that means we then take those genes and look at them base by base and sequence them all to see if there really is a mistake in there. And then what do we know about that gene? What's been published? Does it cause diseases? Have other doctors seen it? Is it in a genetic database? And then we may be left with 30 potential variants that might be clinically significant. So you can see what has to be done to rule out the iffy things or the possible things or the things of not really clear significance. So there might be consents. If someone is undergoing this, there may be a consent that says, we are only going to tell you what's related to your immune system that we find. The rest we're not going to touch. And then it's your decision about whether to join the study or not. Because if you really want to know the rest of the things, and you've got to negotiate that.
Who is going to know the output of what they got? Who owns the list of the possible defects?
Good question. It's your data, right?
Yeah.
Right. Right. But that's why you have to go back to the consent before you go into the study to see what you agreed to. And because the docs, this takes a lot of time to figure out the iffy things. And they want to, if it's research, those docs are going to want to only deal with what they're interested in. They don't want to have to come tell you you've got a cancer gene or something else like that. So this gets us into this conversation. Returning incidental findings, results, or not to return them. And do you have the right to learn or not learn about your own incidental findings? So here is one of the guidelines that the American College of Medical Genetics has developed. I think, this is me as the nurse, and I've sat on IRBs where we have to approve consents and studies, and I'm always the one when the doc says, we're not going to return incidental findings, I absolutely get pretty hysterical about they have the right to know this if they want to know it. They should be able to choose whether they want to know that or not. So the genetics community has looked at this situation, and if a patient has said, I don't want to know anything except what we're looking for. I want you to tell me only about the immune-related things. I don't want to know about anything else. The genetics community has decided, or it's not a rule, but it's a guideline, that even if you say that I don't want to know, there are between 50 and 60 medically actionable disorders that they feel like would be doing you harm if they didn't tell you about them. So their statement reads, it's a fiduciary duty to prevent harm by warning patients and their families about certain incidental findings that this principle supersedes the concerns about autonomy. And those disorders are things like hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. There are some connective tissue disorders, that are associated with severe bleeding and immediate death, like Marfan syndrome. If you have a dilated aorta, it could rupture and dissect, and one could be dead. If someone found the gene for that disorder and that follows this policy, they might come tell you about that, whether you want to know about it or not. So the recommendation in this guideline is that they should, because it's medically actionable, that there is an intervention available that could prevent death. One of them, the other condition is malignant hypothermia. So if a person had a gene for that and had no idea and so far had not been to surgery, but they needed to go in for some small thing or even some big thing, they could die from anesthesia and not know they had the gene. So that's why the genetics community says that if their advice to other people who do this kind of testing, if they're one of these disorders, and there's a list of them and they're published, then you should go tell the patient that they have this disorder, whether they want to know it or not. So that's for you to think about. And I used to think, well, that's pretty paternalistic, till I saw a list of diseases. And if I had one of those and I didn't know, or my family had a malignant hyperthermia gene, I think that's significant. So I've taken a second look at this personally about that. But again, that's why I was asking you about what options does the consent process outline. So if the consent process says, I have two consents that I run at NIH, and one of the consents when I'm talking to patients says, we're going to look for this gene, and it's up to you about what you want us to do with the other disease-causing genes we find. So I write in my consent note what the patient wants. They want to know about all disease-causing genes, or they want to know about only the disease-causing ones. And I can tell you it's not statistical, it's not something I've calculated the results about, but the younger generation, the young adults, say, I only want to know about the immune disease, I don't want to know about anything else. And then my older population all want to know. I want to know everything that's there. The other consent that I run says specifically, if we do whole exome sequencing on you, we're only going to tell you about disease-causing genes. And so I have to show them that very carefully so they can make that decision. If they want to know everything and we're telling them we're not going to tell you everything, then don't join that study. Get it someplace else where they will tell you. So I just wanted to leave our conversation with this slide saying there's hope, because if the gene for your particular immune condition has not been identified, just hang in there. Because so much is being done. We're learning more and more and more every year. This year alone, there's been 30 new genes identified that are related to the immune system. So The methodology and technology is there. It's even ahead of us. That's why we have to stop as humans and figure out, what does this data mean? Is it really disease-causing? Because if I come back and say, you know, you've got this little variation and I think it's causing your problem, but I really don't know, that's not responsible of me. So we do have to stop and look at that data very thoughtfully before we return it to you. So, I'm over, sorry. So let me check out something. Is your knowledge about genes and chromosomes a little broader?
Yes.
Do you think it's important to have a genetic diagnosis? Can you differentiate between a single gene test and whole exome sequencing? Can you describe some of the complexities of whole exome sequencing? Then we've had a successful meeting together. Thank you very much.